Thank you, Spencer. What would you say is the secret to longevity, the secret to long life? Is it heredity, your genes, family history? Is it diet, exercise, supplements? Of course, all those are a major part of it. But I saw a study not too long ago that talked about this surprising factor in longevity, job satisfaction. Job satisfaction. Do you enjoy what you're doing for a living? Now, some of you are thinking, oh, no, Brother Scott, if that's the case, then here's an illustration for the 70s. I'm going to have to get one from the new millennium. Fred Sanford, oh, I feel the big one. I'm coming, Elizabeth. That's what I want to talk about this morning. Not Fred Sanford, but about transformed work. There are some who've computed that we spend between 150,000 and 200,000 hours in our lifetime at our workplace. Man, that's a third of who we are. That's a chunk of our identity, our work. Well, I want to pose the question this morning, how can I succeed in our dog-eat-dog business world and not deny or jeopardize or somehow to walk away from my faith? How can I survive the rat race without becoming a rat? How can I reconcile relating to people in a Christ-like way and still be successful in a competitive marketplace? In short, how can I succeed in my job and still be a transformed, radiant, spirit-filled Christian? This is real. Man, this is relevant. Most Christians I've known through the years have struggled with this because we're going to encounter at our workplace people and pressures and expectations that are going to pull us away from living this transformed life that we desire. I have two things I want to talk about this morning, two thoughts in living this transformed life at work. Hey, I liked what Dr. Harris said last week about when asked how many points a sermon should have. You remember he coyly answered, well, at least one. Well, I've got two points, two thoughts. Maybe one of them will stick, maybe one of them will soak in about being a transformed person at work. First, I want to talk about what doesn't work. This is from my just life experience and from my own observation. Here's what doesn't work. Be a loudmouth at your work about your faith and about religion. Be dogmatic. Be sarcastic. Be snarly. Quote often from Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, be loud and harsh and strident about Obamacare and illegal aliens and your love for Duck Dynasty and Hobby Lobby and Chick-fil-A and your Second Amendment rights to bear arms. Got your attention now, didn't I? Folks, let me tell you, you probably are 100% right about all your opinions and judgments on those social issues, and the other guy 100% wrong. But so often it's our attitude, our heart, our spirit that causes our coworkers to be dismissive of us or totally avoid us. You know, Christ could have flipped over the tables in the temple probably every day of his 3-year ministry because the issues didn't change. They didn't go away. But he didn't. He chose other strategies for dealing with people. We had some neighbors growing up in our little hometown of Madison, Tennessee, the Atnips. And the Atnips were a reclusive little couple. I saw their car once a week. Mr. Atnip would go out and buy groceries and come back with a sack or two. And reclusive little couple, never had children, I suppose. Mrs. Atnip was in a wheelchair, a big woman in a wheelchair, lost her leg, I think it was diabetes, but she lived behind the plate glass window of their living room. There was a little porch in front of this plate glass window. On pretty days, she'd be out on the porch. Most of the day, she spent behind the plate glass window in her wheelchair. And my, oh my, if our baseball or basketball, football were to go in her yard, I can see her bursting out that door, rolling her wheelchair down the ramp, yelling, and get off my lawn, fussing and cussing. Well, maybe she wasn't cussing, but I remember my brother and I were terrified of that old woman. And truthfully, sometimes I would leave our ball in her yard and wait for the cover of nightfall to dart across there and to retrieve our baseball or basketball. And now my mom was sweet to them. On Christmas, Easter, I guess Thanksgiving, she'd fix up a big old platter of food, and my brother and I would trudge across the way and go up to their door and knock, and she'd grunt a little bit and take the platter and slam the door. Well, folks, we got to be careful that we, as the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, aren't kind of viewed like this old eccentric neighbors. Southside has distinguished itself through decades of being good neighbors. We want to be warm, gregarious, generous neighbors. That's our desire. But we've got to be careful that, as the church, we're not viewed as just so some old eccentric neighbors to avoid. Thought number one about living a transformative Christian life at your workplace. It's our attitude. Take this job and love it. God created work as a part of His plan for mankind. There's dignity in work. Adam cultivates the garden. Adam is working by the sweat of his brow, and we continue to do the same. John 5:17, Jesus said, "My Father is working still, and I am working." Man, in this day of high unemployment, we ought to be just thankful to have a job. Or maybe it's more like people my age or a little older that kind of get shoved out because of a forced early retirement that you weren't really seeking. How thankful we are for our jobs. Grateful and thankful. There's no joy in a life of idleness. I met our new neighbors out in Burleson. They moved in a few weeks ago, several months ago now, I guess. Went over there the day that they moved in and introduced myself to Larry. And Larry, I found out, was a retired A&M professor and a little bit older than me, perhaps. And he's got a gorgeous lawn. He's mowing his grass three times a week, at least three times a week. Larry's out here mowing his grass. And I went over to compliment Larry last week about his lawn when he was asking about Teresa. And I said, "Man, your yard is great." And he said, "Yeah, but man, I'm kind of regretting retiring. I'm mowing my lawn three times a week." Leisure isn't always a blessing. Mark Twain said, "I've always been able to gain my living without doing any work. For the writing of books and magazines material was always play, not work. I enjoyed it. It was merely billiards to me." Our attitude at work makes all the difference. It can be merely billiards to us. Don't get a new job. Be a new person at the same old job. Thank God for your job. I want to live a life of thanksgiving. This sermon is for me. I want to live a life of thanksgiving. I don't want to become a grumbly, bitter old coot, mad at the world for all the injustices in the world or at my workplace and such. I want to live a life of gratitude. What was the original sin in the garden? Satan, the beautiful angel, was ingrate. He wanted more. And Adam and Eve chomped the same fruit of ingratitude. They had it all. They're in the paradise. They're in Eden, but they want more. Ingratitude was the original sin. I don't want to become cynical and bitter. In Luke 22, verse 19, the last night of Jesus' earthly life, Matthew referenced it. He's with his men celebrating the Passover meal. He takes the bread, he breaks it, and he gives thanks. The word there, the original, the way that it would be transliterated into English is Eucharistio, from which comes our word Eucharist, communion, Lord's Supper. He gives thanks. But not just gave thanks. Oh, by the way, the root of the word Eucharistio is the word charis, which is our word grace. But Christ didn't just say grace. He lived grace. He's at the tomb of Lazarus in John 11:41. And before he raises his old pal from the dead, before he raises the dead, same word, Eucharistio, he gives thanks. Some of us will only give thanks after we've seen the miracle. Christ gave thanks before the miracle. To live in the will of God is to live a Eucharistio life. To live ungratefully is a return to Eden. The summer my freshman year in college, I had a crummy, miserable job in downtown Nashville. I was working at Buford Brothers Automotive Warehouse. And I hated that place. The warehouse was un-air-conditioned. I was a lowly little stock boy making minimum wage out here in the warehouse. They had a 30-minute period for lunch, and I didn't like that. And my coworkers, holy cow, they were pagans, losers, punks and thugs, and they were lewd and crude and rude. And I hated that place, hated every minute of Buford Brothers Automotive Warehouse. Well, I remember once coming home, and as usual in the evening, I was griping about my job and griping about my paycheck and griping about those pagans that had the morals of a bunch of alley cats with whom I worked. I said, "Mom, pray that I can get a new job." She said, "Now wait a minute now. Hold on. Slow down. Reconsider. I've heard you talk about wanting to be a missionary when you get out of school. Why don't you think about being a missionary, making your work a mission field? Be a voice for God. Be a sermon in shoes. Don't be a know-it-all college kid." I didn't change jobs that summer. I changed me. I quit my griping. I decided I wasn't going to let this disdain show that I had for my coworkers, all this moral superiority that I'd summoned up somehow, this haughty attitude. I went back to Buford Brothers Automotive Warehouse the next summer. Maybe I learned to be a good influence on some of these guys, but I learned to respect, even like, many of my coworkers. I decided I was going to work at the old job with a new attitude, humble and thankful. Someone said, "No man is fit for the great places of service who has not prepared himself by fidelity in obscurity." Fidelity in obscurity. Loyal in denim as we are in diamonds. Point number one is attitude. Here's my second, last point. Excellence. How did Jesus spend the hidden years at Nazareth? Those 18 years between the time we see him at 12 in the temple in Jerusalem and the time of 30 when his ministry is launched? We know the answer to that. Mark 6 verse 3 says he was a carpenter. In Matthew 3:17, he goes down to the Jordan River to be immersed. And after his immersion, there's this voice from heaven that erupts. You remember, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Well, kind of put those two verses in juxtaposition there. You know, I don't see this as a declaration of God's good pleasure upon how he endured the temptations of the wilderness. That comes later in chapter 3. Or his teachings, or his miracles, that's later. Or how he endured the old rugged cross. All that is, of course, later in his ministry. And I see this as more just a divine affirmation of his baptism and God's approval of his baptism. I see it more as a benediction and as a synopsis of those hidden years, those 18 years. Jesus was a carpenter in Nazareth, pleasing God. Before Gethsemane's garden, before Calvary's cross, comes the carpenter shop. He was serving God faithfully in the carpenter shop. Exodus chapter 4, God says to Moses, "Hey, Moses, old buddy, old pal, what's that in your hand?" And Moses says, "You mean this? This old thing? It's a stick. It's my staff. It's just an old dead piece of wood. I use it for walking. It's my walking stick." "What's in your hand, Moses? What's in your hand?" No. "Not just a stick, not just an old dead piece of wood. It's the staff of Moses that's going to become the rod of God, the rod of Jehovah, by which mighty miracles are executed." What's in your hand? Right now, what's in your hand. For Jochebed, it was straw. I think I'll make a little basket. I'll hide my baby boy from the Pharaoh. For Hannah, it was her little boy, Samuel. That was in her hand, and she dedicates him to the master. For the little boy with the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, what's in your hand? Oh, it's my lunch. Here, you need it? My friend, Mr. Phil Elmore, is here today. He's going to be speaking, for those that like to come to the elective Bible class, about 7 habits of highly effective people. I've heard Mr. Elmore, he's the CEO of Christian Care Center, of which Lakewood Village is a part of that family, by the way. I've heard him give this presentation multiple times in professional settings, and it's excellent. But Phil, I don't know if I've ever told you this story. In fact, I just thought about it this morning, thinking about you being here. Does anybody know the name Hewlin Jackson? Hewlin was an old preacher. He was a contemporary with Wyatt and greatly beloved in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He was preaching at the Duncanville Church of Christ. This is way back yonder. I was preaching at the DeSoto Church. I was younger than Steve. If anybody sees Brother Clower this morning, pretend like you don't see him, by the way. He's on sabbatical, remember. But I was younger than Steve, preaching at the DeSoto Church of Christ, and old Brother Jackson was preaching at the Duncanville Church. And this is back when the churches used to bring birthday cakes and pies and such out to Christian Care Center Mesquite once a month to have a big birthday shindig for the residents in the nursing home. Well, evidently, the year before, Duncanville had kind of fizzled on making the pies and cakes. And so Brother Jackson, on a Sunday morning, gets up, and he starts exhorting the members of the Duncanville Church to remember that on Tuesday to bring your pie or cake, and we're all going to go out to Christian Care Center in Mesquite, and we're going to have the big birthday party. Well, the story goes, if I'm remembering all this right, that somehow Brother Jackson so inspired the folks there at the Duncanville Church that the number 373 is in my head. 373 cakes and pies ended up at Christian Care Center in Mesquite for the residents of the nursing home. They ended up having to sell them to employees and had their own little kind of bake sale and such to raise money for activities. What's in your hand? What's in your hand now? Not one day when I get out of school and when I get married and when the kids are grown and when I'm retired. What's in your hand right now, Moses? Oh, you mean this whole thing? It's just a stick. 3 pitfalls in the book of Proverbs. In chapter 1, I nearly said pit bulls. I knew that wasn't right. Pitfalls. Chapter 1, it's bad company. In chapter 5, it's bad women, wicked women, bad women. In chapter 6, it's the pitfall of bad work habits. Remember the contrast between the industrious ant and the sloth? Well, for 18 years, Jesus lived amongst the little happenings of that little village of Nazareth, dealing with the humdrum tasks and the petty cares and the village gossips. And he's faithful in the carpenter shop. He wore the crown in the carpenter shop. It was never off his brow. In Genesis chapter 24, Abraham is an old man. His beloved wife, Sarah, has died. He's worried about his boy, Isaac, who's the promised one. He's the most eligible bachelor. They made a television show about him back in Canaan years ago. He's the most eligible bachelor in all of Canaan. And he's the promised one through whom the Messiah will come. But he's knocking on the door of 40 and he's still single. And Abraham decides he's going to nudge this process along. So he summons his old trusted faithful servant. His name is given in chapter 15 as Eliezer. He said, Eliezer, here's what I want you to do. Go back to my homeland, back to Mesopotamia, to Nahor, and find a girl for our boy. Find a girl of, he says in verse 4, my beliefs, our people, our country, of our beliefs. Not the pagan Canaanite women, the wicked women, but one of our girls. And so this old faithful servant takes a caravan, 10 camels, all the way from Cana to Mesopotamia, back to Nahor, to their land of their ancestry. And he gets to the well about the end of the afternoon when it's time for the gals of the city to come out and draw water. And this old servant prays, Lord, help me. let the girl who comes out and not only offers me drink, but offers to give water to my camels, let her be the one for Master Isaac. Well, while he was praying, you ever had a prayer answered while you're praying it? Eliezer did. While he was praying, here comes this beautiful young gal, sashaying out. Her name is Rebecca. And she does just as he's prayed about. She offers him drink and then offers to give drink to these 10 thirsty camels. And someone has computed that it takes 30 gallons to fill the belly of a thirsty camel. 30 gallons times 10 camels, what is it? That's a lot of water, and that's a lot of work for beautiful young Rebecca. Hand draw that out of a well. And that's the Rebecca principle. That's the Rebecca principle. That's my second point. Work with flair. Work with excellence. Go the second mile. Do more than expected. Draw water for the thirsty camels. In our day, people look for evidence of faith in, I don't know, mega churches or mysticism or goosebumps or healings or speaking in tongues. But I'm suggesting that real Christianity is about giving the camels a drink. Drink enough to fill their thirsty bellies and doing it with a smile on your face. Not moaning and groaning and complaining and begrudgingly, but giving the thirsty camels a drink with a smile on your face. I'm suggesting that the transformed life, the Spirit-filled life, gives this multiple choice. A, it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Or B, it's ordinary people doing ordinary things in an extraordinary way. With passion, with gusto, with pizzazz, over the top. In Genesis 24, back to the story, Eliezer explains his commission to Rebekah's family. They agree. And yes, they give permission for their daughter to go back to this land of Canaan. Yes, she marries Isaac. Yes, she becomes the great, 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 great something. Grandmother of the carpenter, the Messiah. Here's the promise. You walk the second mile. You give camels water till they're filled. The Lord will meet you there at the well. And He'll open doors. And He'll use you in ways that you could have never anticipated. Become a new person at the same old job, working with pizzazz. Of course, of course, of course. We want you to invite people to worship here at Southside, and we want you to invite them to special events and activities and functions that we have here at Southside. And yes, I want you to talk about your faith and your love for the Lord freely and comfortably as opportunities arise at your work. But what I'm stressing this morning is biblical too. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. Colossians 3, 23 and 24, wherever you do, work at it heartily, as for the Lord, not just for men. 1 Kings chapter 7, King Solomon is going to build this resplendent, glorious, incomparable temple in Jerusalem. And he commissions this skilled workman named Hiram to help him construct the temple in Jerusalem. And Hiram builds, he begins by building these two huge pillars, not pillows, pillars, P-I-L-L-A-R-S. My Tennessee accent throws me sometimes. Pillars in support of this temple in Jerusalem. Two huge bronze pillars that soared several stories high. And he was so proud of them, he named them. What were they? Jacob and Boaz. He even named the pillars. And at the very top, it's amazing in 1 Kings 7, 15 through 22, how much detail the Bible goes in to describe in this these two big old pillars. Because at the top, the capitals, it describes in detail this intricate pattern of lilies and pomegranates. And they're so high, there's no human eye could have seen those lilies and pomegranates at the top. No human eye. No human eye. No human eye. God sees our work. He sees the lilies and the pomegranates and the flair and the pizzazz and the over the top and the excellence. Charles Swindoll writes, "Excellence is a difficult concept to communicate because it can easily be misread as neurotic perfectionism or snotty sophistication. But it isn't either. On the contrary, it's a stuff of which greatness is made. It's the difference between just getting by and soaring, that which sets apart the significant from the superficial, the lasting from the temporary." I've been to Africa 3 times in the last 15 years. And man, did anybody take any courses in African history in school and high school or college? All I knew about Africa was the Tarzan movies. And if our friends from Africa knew that that's what we thought about Africa, believe me, they'd been insulted and humiliated, because that's all a bunch of phony baloney, of course. But I've enjoyed reading about Dr. David Livingstone, who is a Scottish medical doctor and Christian missionary into the southern Africa, into central Africa, for about 25 years in the middle 1800s. And what most of us know about Dr. Livingstone, there was this newspaper reporter, Henry Stanley, that was commissioned by the New York Herald. Dr. Livingstone had been missing for like 6 years. People hadn't heard of him. And the newspaper commissioned Henry Stanley, a reporter, to go into deep, dark Africa and to find Livingstone. And after, I think, 2 years of searching, he found Dr. Livingstone. And everybody remembers the famous quote, right? And I'm not sure if it's really true or if it's just a legend. But here's these two white guys meeting in the middle of the jungles of Africa, and he says, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume?" But the best story about David Livingstone, he's gone back to London to try to raise money and manpower for an expedition into Africa. And of course, if you're a missionary, that's what you do. You go raise money. You don't go to London. Now you come to Dallas, Fort Worth, or Abilene, or Nashville, and you raise money. That's what you do if you're a missionary. And he's gone back to London to the National Geographic Society there in London, trying to raise money and manpower. And they say to him, "Have you found Dr. Livingstone? Have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to know how to send other men to join you." And Dr. Livingstone's famous reply was, and hey, I need to hear this, "If you have men who will come only if they know that there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come if there is no road at all." Yep, yep, yep. And that's Christianity. It's uncharted territory. It's being a missionary at your workplace. Thank you for your spirits and your heart in your Monday through Friday world. Sure, on Sunday, we come here, we take communion, we sing praises, we pray, we go to Bible class. Terrific. But I'm talking about Monday through Friday. Thank you. Thank you for your sweat. Thank you for your excellence. Thank you for the lilies and pomegranates. Thank you for watering the camels. By doing so, you're influencing people one by one by one at your workplace for the cause of Christ. Thank you. Your efforts are appreciated and valued even by the Holy One above. Is there a spiritual need this morning that's burdening you, troubling you? We'll have ministers and elders around the auditorium ready to love on you, pray with you, encourage you in Christ. Perhaps this morning you want to state your conviction to be born again from above, born of the water and the Spirit, to be immersed into Christ. All things are ready. Whatever the need would be, we'd urge you to come right now. Gather, we stand and sing.